a shotgun lovers, I'm a shotgun running away. So come a little closer, there is something I can tell you. It was such a roller coaster. Nights that we traveled, we stole. You let your clothes fall to the floor and lit a fire all the way to the morning. And now I'm running and I won't stop. I don't wanna go, I think about it every day and night. I can't let go. And hey, I'm never the same. It's 100 miles an hour on a dirt road running away. So come a little closer. There is something I can tell you. It was such a roller coaster.
Hello everyone, you're listening to CKUT Radio and this is STEMinism, a show where we talk about science from the perspective of underrepresented groups. And today we are very pleased to have a special guest, Fred. He did his PhD in the lab of Dr. Sylvia Villeneuve at the Douglas here in Montreal, and I had the pleasure of being one of his lab mates for 9 months before he graduated and now works for CIHR. Hello Fred.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you. Also, we have Noor and Zayd and Paul in the studio.
Hello.
Yes.
So, Fred, do you want to give our listeners a quick overview of Fred?
Yes, certainly. So, I'm a PhD student. I defended my thesis. I'm still so used to it. I was a PhD student. I defended my thesis this past January. Was working mostly in brain imaging in Alzheimer's disease. And the topic of my thesis was related to inter-individual differences in the brain when looking at patients with Alzheimer's disease or individuals with that are aging normally. And since then, I moved on and I'm now working for the Canadian Institute of Health Research as a full-time data analyst. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So let's talk a bit about the stuff you did in your PhD. You said you studied inter-brain differences. Yes, could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. So the whole point of my thesis was when we take a group of individuals, let's say we take a group of students, mm-hmm. What we usually say is that all the students in that group, we consider them to be relatively the same. Like their brains should be relatively similar. They're about the same age, about the same education, mm-hmm. etc. But what the literature is starting to show is that even when we take this group of homogenized people, there's still a lot of differences. Mm-hmm. And how we can show this is through a method that we call fingerprinting. Because what we do is we take your brain, and then we're usually able to match it to your own brain in a bank of subjects when we take like a random group of people. So mm-hmm. let's say I scan your brain now as can your brain tomorrow, mm-hmm. your brain is going to look more similar to your own brain compared to anyone else.
That makes sense. I hope my brain wouldn't change too much.
Yeah, right?
Yes.
But it kind of goes against the idea that everyone in a group is very homogenous mm-hmm. because everyone's a little bit different. There's those differences. So we were wondering, how important are those differences? And do they actually matter when it comes to clinical questions? Let's say Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. We usually assume that everyone is going to have the same trajectory. They're going to all have memory impairment, but that's not usually the case. And we were wondering, well, can we develop some methods to help investigate that? So, like, can we develop a method to help us differentiate individuals and have, let's say, a unique brain signature of your own Alzheimer's disease?
So, like, your brain's own, like, just by... So, is it all by the structure of the brain? Okay.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that in my studies, I work mostly with functional MRI, so really the activity of the brain.
So it's more the combination of the structure and the function of the brain, which shows you the differences between neurotypical and people with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that we can find, let's say, this fingerprint, this unique activity of your brain or this unique structure of your brain, we can find it no matter the modality that you use. So I did it with structural imaging, I did it with functional imaging, I even did it with PET imaging.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
These are all very different because like PET uses like a radioactive molecule.
That's right.
Structural looks at the structure, fMRI at the activity. And are you able to extract like the same fingerprint from all of those? Or is there like a different fingerprint for each modality that you use?
So that's probably where the reviewers on my paper would have liked me to go next, but that's I didn't go that far, unfortunately, because really what we were doing is taking, let's say, the volume in all the brain regions and correlating them together. So just like we correlate them between two different modalities or two different activities, and then we see if they correlate well with one another.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for explaining. That was pretty cool.
So how do you... like your research is very well positioned to be at like sort of the forefront of what we call like translational science. In your experience, like with your PhD research and having published like a lot of this work, how far or how near is that from actual reality, like of informing decision-making, things like that?
Pretty far, unfortunately. Yeah. 'Cause right now I think a lot of, let's say, the personalized medicine work is really oriented to trying to find, or at least to trying to account for different groups, like the fact that I'm a man and then I'm this age. So like kind of using the characteristics, still group level characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. Like sex, age. But I think the step beyond that is more really going at the individual level. And the thing that's really tricky with that is how can you make sure that when you use a measure that's your own, that's your own reference, how can you make sure that when it changes, it's for the bad or for the good? Mm. And that's something that's really hard to do because when you have a group, you see the group decline, you see the group change, you're able to assume certain things about the group overall. But when it is at the individual level, it's a bit more complicated.
Right, that's true. Because all of the metrics in our health are technically measured with reference to the normal of a certain group, right? Like, maybe like, your blood sugar should be within this normal range based on your age, based on your level of activity, but it's all still within group averages. So I think definitely if we were to individualize all these things, it would be way more complicated.
Yeah, but I think like for me, at least the main message that I tried to get out of my thesis was really at least to start considering them. Like when we do analyses, like let's not assume that the 20 students we recruit in like by an ad are all the same.
Yeah.
Like sure, we have some criteria on how we recruit them, on their age, their sex, etc. But like sometimes I wonder if it's enough, and because we can't really capture everything in an ad in like 5 criterias. So maybe sometimes we want to dig deeper, ask more questions, or at least have some measures that consider variability, like the fact that some people are different.
Absolutely. I would say like the brain is unique in that sense, right? Because unlike other organs where you could say, kidneys in general tend to be very similar across people, but brains are quite different and like their structure and the way they activate and the different.
But that's the thing that's interesting too, right? No matter our circumstances, the way the brain develops or the way the brain is, once you're fully grown, like the same brain regions are there across individual, mm-hmm. but their shape, their function, the way they couple with other regions, that can all change from person to person. Mm-hmm. And like that adds that level of complexity. And I mean, like I'm pushing it a bit by saying this, but like it's, for me, it maybe one of the reason why the brain is so complex for us to understand, because there's so much variability that we can only account for so much when we do our analyses, that having those measures at the individual level might help us even better.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Because you mentioned sex differences very shortly, what were the like specific aspects that you found to be different in the fingerprints of like male versus female participants?
That's super interesting because I haven't really looked at that much. but there is one experiment that I did where I took the brain of men by themselves and the brain of women by themselves and then tried to see if there were differences in the fingerprint. And turns out that not really. Like, since it's so unique to each individual, then like I couldn't really see group differences. And that's one of the things that when I use this measure in the different projects that I did, is really it's so unique to each individual that sometimes it's not very useful when we do group level analyses, right? Because it's so distinct from one another that it's good to identify you, but like I don't think we'll have like on our phone a brain scanner to unlock like the phone soon, which is like what we would usually use a fingerprint for. But I think for now, there's more work needed to even try to understand what that fingerprint does.
Mm-hmm. So if we look at a brain fingerprint, we can't tell what group it belongs to because it's highly unique and individualized.
Correct. There are some exceptions because I did try to do it, let's say, with patients with Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And then in that case, the atrophy really spreads in the brain. And there are some group similarities. Like we know for sure that there's some brain regions that are affected across people. So the thing that I found interesting, but we didn't really dig on during my thesis, is that brain fingerprint seems to go down like when patients start to have the disease, which kind of indicates that, yeah, there's like a pattern there that people start to converge and have more symptoms, be more advanced. We didn't really dig into it. So I feel like a little bit of this radio show is like the annex of my thesis because I get to discuss those things. But I would be curious to see if when disease happen, if it's more, if it changes and how it would change.
That is super interesting. Like the Alzheimer's makes even though all these brain fingerprints are different, when this disease shows up in the brain, they all start to degrade in a similar way.
Yeah.
I had a question, just like forgot it.
I could ask one in term. So when you mentioned looking at, you know, Alzheimer's disease, we know that like diseases like that or neurodegenerative disease are typically like called diseases of aging.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if that fingerprint or that signature, you know, you mentioned that it definitely changes during the disease, but do you think it is something that's like dynamic that, or is it something that you sort of get and once you're done, your brain's done developing, that it's set and that's it, and then it only goes up or down from there?
That's a very good question. And actually, the first study that I did in my thesis, we looked at this lifespan sample. So we had like individuals that were 18 years of age all the way to individuals that were 80-something. And then we try to see it in the different decades of life. Is there a change in terms of like being able to be fingerprinted? Mm-hmm. So are people who are, let's say, in their midlife, do they have a cleaner fingerprint? Are we able to identify them better? And what we found that was interesting is that there's kind of like this U shape. So when you're a younger adult, you fingerprint better. Mm-hmm. And when you're old, you also fingerprint better. But when you're in the middle, your fingerprint not as good. Mm. We're not sure why that is. Maybe when you're younger, like your brain is still like fully in good shape, good form. So like it's more unique. And then when you're older, then your life experiences affect your brain in a unique way that's really different from person to person. But again, that's not something we could test, or it was difficult to test in this context, but that would be where I'd like to say, because the literature also shows that when your brain develops, so when you're an infant, you actually have a fingerprint as early, I think, as 2 months old. Wow. But it starts to develop like during your teenage years and then really stabilizes right as you become a young adult. Mm. So it kind of makes sense that it would change as brain development kind of goes on. But it's, I think this is such a new field that like, I'm excited to see what comes next.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever tried to fingerprint brain scans from neurodivergent children?
Neurodivergent, yes. There was this one study where they looked at individuals with that were on the autism spectrum or individuals with ADHD and in developing children and adolescents. And I think what I found interesting in that is that people that are not neurotypical tend to be less fingerprintable. So again, like it's like one study on the topic, but like I found that interesting because for them, they were advertising it more as a biomarker, you know, like mm-hmm. you can use it to maybe find something that's going on in the brain. But for me, it might be an indicator of, well, maybe there's something that's shared across those individuals that we could leverage in some other way.
That's interesting. So I guess my question is, how would you define something that is a good fingerprint versus something that is a bad fingerprint? Like we know that people in between the bell curve that you mentioned, so like people in the mid age have like less fingerprint reliability. And now we know that neurodivergent children might also have less fingerprint reliability. But what does that mean?
It just means less correlation. And that's why I'm saying that it's kind of hard to interpret, because the way we do this is really we take your brain scan at one time, whatever, like a baseline. And then we take another scan a couple days later, a year later. And then what we do is really just correlate the two of them together. So when I say that there's like a dip, normally how we do this is we take the correlation coefficient between you and yourself. Mm-hmm. And we compare that to the correlation between you and everyone else in the cohort.
Right.
So it's that distance between the two that gives us an indicator. Because if you're much further apart from the rest of your group, then it means you're more unique or more different. If you're closer, then it means there's more chances that your brain scan will be misidentified. That like the analysis is going to say that your brain belongs to someone else, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's actually what I wanted to touch on a little bit, because like when we hear fingerprints, you know, I think Mission Impossible, CIA, like it looks very fancy and cool. But what does a brain fingerprint like actually look like to you, like when you're dealing with it on a day-to-day?
Legit, that was the first thing I thought when I heard about your project, like way back last year. I was like, oh, he's doing like criminology stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting.
No, and I mean, I agree. And I think for me, it was a bit of a struggle when I started this project, because it was so abstract, right? Like you read the papers about it and it's like, you can identify someone, but what does it mean? And then it took me a while to kind of resolve this. And in the end, like more so me, who's more like of a coder or programmer, data analyst, like for me, fingerprint is a number. Mm. Like, are you closer to one or are you closer to zero? So it's not this neat and fancy thing where like you have two scans that, let's say, would align with the same colors. Yeah, and then like in the action movie, you would see like pop-ups like somewhere.
That's exactly what I imagined. But instead of a fingerprint, it's like a brain scan. Yeah. That's exactly where my mind went to.
I think in essence, it's the same. I mean, it's the same principle, right? Like, I actually do have a question that, I don't know. My name is Paul, by the way. I'm Fred's husband. And I've been listening to his thesis pitch probably over 500 times. I should be considered an expert as well. But I never thought about this, because you mentioned a lot that you kept comparing the correlation between yourself and then, you know, between others in the cohort.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of, let's say, you know, if you look at technology like facial recognition, it is sort of based on the same thing, but you have like an initial sort of template,
mm-hmm.
and then you match whatever that comes afterwards with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the decision to accept that this is your face or not, I'm sure it's based on a threshold somewhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm wondering if that is something that, you know, would be the next step, or is that something that you are considering, you know, instead of having to depend on, you know, imagine like a large cohort of people that every time you want to do fingerprinting, you have to go into these cohorts all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, that's probably, if I kept being in academia and doing research, that's probably where I would have gone, like trying to better understand what it is, what it means, how to measure it. Because one of the things in the literature is that there's a lot of methods factor that can also influence it. And I mean, like outside of all the cool like matching of things, there's also like the number of people in your cohort, how much the people move in the scan, that also affects how it's fingerprintable, which makes sense because the image quality is less good. So there's all those other factors that also have an impact in the end on how it's measured, on how it is, and trying to get a perfect image of like what would affect it, how can we improve it, that's probably the next step. It's a boring step because it's very methods oriented, very math, trying to figure out like,
hey, I'm a methods project.
It's very interesting. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, like for me, I was more, that was a funny thing because I came in as more of a clinic guy. Like I worked in a memory clinic during my master's, and then I come here, first project, oh, let's do a lot of math and matrix like multiplication and trying to correlate stuff that's very abstract. So
I'm curious. Oh, sorry. I'm Allie. I just joined. So I might have missed this since I just got on, but when you're like getting the fingerprints of your patients, is it just during like baseline, or are they doing some kind of task while you're doing that?
That's a really good question.
Yes, very good question. And actually you can do with both.
Okay.
And what's super interesting is that depending on the task that they do in the scanner, it can be more or less fingerprintable.
Okay.
Like in my own study, I only had two tasks, which was a sensory motor task and a resting task.
Okay.
And even correlating the two together, there's like really this fingerprint. And initially, you would think that, let's say they do the sensory motor task, should activate the same brain regions, so it should be not as much fingerprintable.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case. It was like you can still be fingerprinted. It's like, which kind of reinforces this idea that your brain has this signature that shows up no matter what you do in the scanner.
That's so cool. I always thought that people's brains would, like when it comes to basic things like sensory motor tasks that involve the same motor cortex and the same sensory cortex and so on, I always thought that would be super similar. It's very cool that this is fingerprintable and it shows up differently in different individuals' brains. Like that's
and I mean,
a lot to think about.
Not only that, but one of the analyses we did is we really looked at the brain networks, right? Because there are some that come back across everyone. But the one thing that really stood out to me and that we ended up putting in a corner and supplementary figure somewhere, but that's for me, that's one of the highlights, is that when we take a random assortment of brain region, not networks, not anything, if we have enough of them, we can fingerprint. Doesn't matter where in the brain we look, doesn't matter if it's a specific network. There are some networks that are better than others, but even when we take this random assortment of brain region, this signature is still there. We can still identify you.
Are these on patients with a condition
So those, that's a big caveat in the field right now, is that a lot of those studies are conducted on younger individuals. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was cognitively healthy participants that were aged between 18 and 88. You should remember that from my defense, Paul.
Yeah.
But, did you even listen, yeah, Paul?
Just too many numbers. Too many numbers all the time. Yeah.
But I'd say that most of the studies in the field right now use a single cohort, which is the Human Connectome Project, which is really a nice cohort. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of really good sampling imaging. There's a lot of modalities, but it's mostly individuals that are white. It's mostly individuals that come from the same regions in the U.S., highly educated. So it kind of faces the same idea that we face everywhere else in replication in science, is that like our cohorts or samples are not super diverse, and that's definitely something that I would have liked to explore more, but since we didn't collect data for this, we're kind of limited. We can't push recruitment for specific data, but yeah, so unfortunately very homogeneous.
Mm-hmm. So you've been mentioning a lot of things that you would have done had you continued research, but you chose to move on to a more industry-oriented position.
That's right.
So I guess I have two main questions that I think everyone is thinking about. How? Why did you move into the industry? And do you think that by your position, you would still be able to pursue these goals that you have, even if it's not in the same way?
Very good question. And I'd say that it's been, I mean, it's been quite an odyssey, like changing from academia to industry, right? We're like through our whole process in academia, we're kind of, what we want to do is really become PIs. We want to become professors. We want to do research. That's what we live and thrive on.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And I'd say that for me, it was really the same. And like research is really what I love to do. I love to teach. I love to research. I love to ask like really random questions at 2 a.m. and then like have to code something to check it. But the thing for me with academia is that there's so much pressure to go further to get anywhere. Like if you want to be a PI, then it takes so many papers, really high impact journals. You need to be from a good university. You need to keep going even when you become a PI. You need to publish more.
Yeah, and they have like a limit of how many, like you need to have a minimum number of published papers in some institutions.
Correct.
And even to become a PI, you need to have to do a postdoc, sometimes two or three postdocs, depending on your experiences. And it depends also on how many papers you're able to push out. And depending on the field you're in, it can be significantly difficult to put papers out. Like if, let's say, you're working on some model that requires just years to be able to sample. Like in your case, if you do, for example, longitudinal studies.
Exactly. And I think for me, that's something that I was willing to put up with it. But then I saw a lot of colleagues of mine who went to do, let's say, postdocs, and then they were there for a long time, couldn't get a job afterwards. And then it would also mean that I would have to travel, right? I would have to do a postdoc abroad, because doing a postdoc in the same city that you did your PhD, that's not looked at on well.
Right, that's true.
So I think for me, it's just the accumulation of those things, the pressures, the behaviors of some people in academia as well. Those are things that like I wasn't necessarily keen on keeping going. So I kind of sought out alternatives. But even then, I'd say that it's kind of hard to look outside, because as PhD students, we're so trained on working within academia that we don't really know that all the skills that we have can be applied elsewhere. And I was listening to your last show, and then I think you had a discussion about that, like of how we're like we have many skills as PhD students, and then that's something that the PhD doesn't really train us to apply elsewhere, to apply outside. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I was coding in R, I was coding in Python. That is still what I do in my day to day, and like I still work with data, I still work with in the research environment. So those are all things that I gained through my my PhD and then applying now. And I'd say, yeah, the reason was balance, work-life balance. I wanted to be able to travel. Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's also your, I mean, you know, from having seen you grown through the years, it's also your ability to sort of approach problems and solve them and know where to go, know where to look. And sort of, you know, like how to test hypotheses. I think these are things that, you know, you learn through your PhD, your discipline, you know, your determination and all these things too. So outside of just the, you know, your theoretical knowledge and hard skills, but you've also learned, you know, a bunch of other things too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds to me like academia poses a lot of barriers. Like not necessarily barriers that even have to do with how good you are or how motivated you are. Like some people are unable to leave the city that they did their PhDs in. Some people have a lot of different barriers that get in the way. And it seems like academia is really made to favor some people with certain privileges that allow them to go on and push further.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's no secret to anyone, but let's just think of the money we get when we're in academia, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's not a lot of money. We
got money?
getting paid?
Just mentioning in passing.
It's like that meme where it's like, you know, you keep getting less and less, and then the last one, it's like, are you getting paid for this?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Incidentally, it's from the Millers movie.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Incidentally, they just announced increases for PhDs and postdocs.
Yes. Oh my God.
You have to ask. I mean, because he works at the CIHR now, so.
Yeah.
And he holds all that.
No, exactly. So that's what I was going to ask about. I was like, hey, were you involved in this? And B, thank you.
Well, to be fair, I've only been there for 3 months, so yeah. Not really. And like everyone in Canada, we see the budget when it comes out. So yes. Like when the news came out, then I learned the information at the same time. But I think in general, this announcement is something that I would have been really happy with as well during my mm-hmm. studies, right? Mm-hmm. I think when I was still a PhD student, the salary at McGill had been capped at the same max for like, yeah. I don't know, 10, 15 years, yeah, something like that.
Too long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now I have to admit that one of the things that I was so happy with starting a new job is then when you open your bank account after gaining your first paycheck and you see the amount there and you're like, is that right? Is that like the right amount?
Wow. Yeah.
How do you feel now about your decision to leave academia? Because I have noticed that people in academia often kind of look down on anyone who leaves as like, oh, you're not doing your postdoc. Like yeah. Anything you do outside of academia is like less worthy, I guess. And
yeah.
So how do you deal with that shame?
That's a very hard question because I feel like for me, I had the feeling that throughout a lot of my PhD, it was always constantly that I wasn't pushing hard enough. And then once I really made my decision to leave, then it was like I heard messages from a bunch of different people saying that, well, why do you leave now? You're doing good. Like you're gonna have a hard time in the industry. They still work like crazy every time. Like it's not gonna be better once you leave. And then at that point for me, I had really willed like my decision. Like that's it. I want to leave. And then I left. But even leaving is a bit isolating sometimes because we don't have those resources here at the university. Like. We don't do a class on how to use our PhD skills outside of academia. And I think sometimes it's a bit of a struggle. I still remember when I applied for jobs and I had publications in there and I'm like, yeah, I mean, like academic, like when you do anything academia, you put your publications. Mm-hmm. This is like your prestige. And then I remember talking to the first person I talked to in human resources and they basically disregarded that whole section. They didn't understand what that means. It's valueless outside of academia.
This is crazy to me. That I did not expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spend like 5 to 8 years, however long your PhD takes, just trying to get papers out.
Yeah. I know.
And then someone looks at it as
like in high impact journals too. Like,
yeah.
I know. Yeah. But in the end, like once you get out, it doesn't really matter because what they look for is more the skills that you did during your paper, right? Like for me, if I break it down, my first paper was really about like the fingerprinting, right? But how do we translate that to industry? Well, for me, I banked on the fact that I could code. I could code Python, I could code R. I did machine learning in that project. That's what I sold forward. Not the paper itself, because no one cares, but like, yeah, I know it's weird to say, like, but that's really how it is outside. And like in the beginning, it was hard for me to believe. But the more people I talked to, and I mean, even my husband, like he was also in academia, did his PhD at Queen's in epidemiology, now out in industry as well.
Oh wow!
And so I'm the worst shame. So we had some. It's like, well, at least I didn't go full industry, but yeah, that's.
You know,
took the same decision.
That's pretty cool, though. I feel like what like Amelie described is that like people like academic people regard as people who leave academia with shame. But yeah. What I've also found is that industry people are just smiling with paychecks. Yeah.
And because we sleep.
They sleep.
Oh, I don't know about that. But yeah.
Like, I find that there's a very funny balance where I can just imagine there's like a two-side wall. And on one side, you have academics that are like resentful that people are leaving. And they're like postdocs and they're getting paid like 30K a year or something. And then like on the other side, you have like people on the industry that are like quite pleased with what they've done, and they're happy that they left all that behind.
And I mean, I'd say I think it really depends on I guess on where you land to, right? Because now that I've seen the other side, I know some people who are thinking of going back to academia who don't like it as much in industry, because it's always a balance of things, right? In academia, you work more in the evenings and everything, but we're also being sold on the flexibility, the fact that like if like a week or a weekend you need to go or you want to work abroad, that's something that's doable. But it's not always possible on when you take a job in industry. And I think for me, I definitely do not regret it. I think for me the moment that really made me say, okay, I definitely do not regret it is last month I went on vacation.
Wow.
And that was my first paid vacation.
Please don't throw the V word. Please don't throw the V word lightly like that.
I know, I'm sorry. But for me, it wasn't even just the fact of going to vacation, but it was the fact that I left my work phone at home. I left my laptop at home. I did not have any way of looking at my things when I was abroad. And then during my travel, I couldn't even think about it. You know, I didn't think about working, and then going back to it. When I came back, I was like, okay, well, yeah, like I'm ready for work, you know. But when I was taking vacation in academia, well, once I was working during, but then once I left, then for my vacation, I'm like, I need to work. Once I come back, I'm like, ugh, I worked the whole vacation. Now I'm gonna work again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you like in industry still keep tabs on the literature, on like what's being published or what's recent and whatnot, or is that now an element that you don't have to worry about so much?
It really depends. I mean, first of all, like I no longer work with anything neuroscience related, right? So I'm kind of lucky because at my own in my own team there's a lot of PhDs and postdocs, so we have our own journal clubs. And funny enough, I've done more journal clubs now at my work than I used to do during my PhD. So
my condolences. I hate well, those.
I know. But they're actually nice because I think the main difference that I see doing them now is that you do them with a purpose. Like you do them to try to show something that could improve the business. You show them just to maybe take a break and discuss and like... have fun with an article or think like how we could improve our processes. So it feels like there's more purpose rather than sometimes talking about papers that half of your lab doesn't understand. And then like, yes, there can be discussion, but then like you add it to the pile of things you want to do and the pile is like 50.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's true.
How does your day-to-day differ like now than before?
I start at 8:30, I finish at 4:30, and I have an hour like off break during the day. Oh my God. And I'd say that for me, that's the biggest change. Because like in terms of task by itself, like what I work for is for the funding analytics unit. And what we deal with is people who have questions for the CIHR in terms of how much money we gave to an institution or internally, how much money or pulling out different applications. And a lot of what I do nowadays involves machine learning, involves cleaning data, sending data. So I'm really into R a lot, Python here and there. So weirdly enough, the type of day-to-day isn't that different in the sense that I have a terminal open in front of me, I have R open, I have Python open, mm-hmm. I code, which is most of what I was doing to my PhD. But now I start really at fixed times. I have team meetings. It's a lot more collaborative as well because I have meetings every week with my supervisor. I have like team meetings every week as well. We share a different tricks to help each other out when we work on data. Huh. So
Yeah, I think it's not the during the day activities that change, but it's the after work activities. Because from seeing you for the past 3 months, it's just been different. Like you were able to shut, you know, work out.
Yeah.
After I mean, you used to talk.
4:30. Yeah. Before work.
Exactly.
And I think in the longer run, at least this is from my experience as well, is that your work doesn't become you.
Yeah.
Like you, if things don't work out, it doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. And it's just fine. Like, it's okay. We'll move on. We do other things. It's not like there are other things that we can do. But, you know, in academia, I feel like a lot of the times, like, your next 3 months depend on this one, you know, click when you send the code to run in R. And it was like, oh, okay. So now it's going to be a shitty 3 months. It's not going to have anything good. But, you know, it doesn't really happen that much.
That's anymore. True. And I think, like, that shift is, for me, what's been the hardest coming out. Because I'm still dealing with some level of, I guess I could call it academic PTSD. Like, you're still thinking of, like, I'm still finishing work sometimes, and I'm like, should I really not check my stuff? Should I, like, did I do okay? Did I perform right? Did I do up to expectations?
Right.
But I think the way that people look at this outside of academia is just very different, right? Like, I talked to my supervisor, and then I handed my work, and then, like, the work is good, and then I'm done. And then the project ends there after a couple of days, couple hours sometimes. And I think I'm always wondering, like, did I do enough? Did I, like, pursue all the avenues? But we still, while still being careful, I don't have to over worry myself. I don't have to over worry that, like, if I don't perform well enough, then I'm not going to advance in my career, or that, like, if I don't do this really complicated analysis on the data, then I'm not going to be able to move forward. It's pretty clear how you can move forward, what you need to do to move forward. And, like, when you do projects, you get a lot of feedback, often constructive feedback right away. I know in academia, I was pretty lucky because I had access to my supervisor to have a feedback relatively quickly, but I know it's not the case for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So one of the criticisms that we, like, keep hearing over and over again, like, in academia, right, with regards to industries, that you don't have as much, like, we'll call it intellectual freedom or liberty to do or pursue what you want.
Yeah.
How much of that is a factor in, like, in your day to day? And, like, does it actually, you know, ring on in your head a lot, or?
So it really depends. I think me personally, I'm really lucky because like my supervisor, my department head, they're both PhDs, actually in neuroscience as well. And, like, more than half the team is PhD in neuroscience. And it's like this weird thing that we keep laughing about. But I think since we all come from academia, we understand that sometimes we can have ideas that are a little bit outside the mold, mm-hmm. but could help the business later down the road. So we have a portion of our work that is more, it's not really independent project, but it's more like we can give our ideas on how to advance the business, things we see that can be improved. And there's a lot of opportunities to learn. Because I think, same for me, I was a bit worried of, am I still going to be able to learn once I leave? Am I going to keep stimulating my brain in the same way, or is it going to be boring, repetitive? And no, I mean, since I started there, I learned a new way of coding in R, which is like R Shiny packages, like making dashboards, which is something that I've never done before, but it's been nice to kind of jump in and have time to learn it. And then in return, I can use that and help the business by creating dashboards, making it simple for users to use them. So on that end, I've been very satisfied. But I will say that it's not always the case. I think Paul is also pretty lucky too, like, because in your experience, you have some
freedom. Yeah, but it definitely, there's some, you know, restrictions. I mean, when I was doing my PhD, my whole interest was in mental health. Like, you know, I did, my thesis, I looked at the associations between, you know, cultural adaptability, if you might say, to mental health among, mental health status among university students at Queens. And then I went full industry, as in, like, his Fred at least is in government. So it's government's like kind of a bit of a hybrid. I'm in consulting. I'm in healthcare consulting. So I work with pharmaceutical companies. They come with research questions, and then we you know, we gather data, you know, we buy them or whatever, and then we try to answer their research, whatever curiosities that they have. So we're bounded by that. We're bounded by, you know, agendas, if you will. I don't have a lot of freedom to choose in terms of what areas I want to be in. Like right now I work with, you know, an autoimmune disease, and another project is cancer related. The other is, there was one, mental health actually. So yeah, certainly. I mean, I have not really worked with anything mental health much at all. Mm-hmm. Certainly not to my academic interest when I was doing my PhD. So it does. But on the flip side, you also get to learn all, you know, all the other things like Fred was saying, like R Shiny and stuff like that. Now I code in SAS, which is a very obscure statistics language that no one uses outside of healthcare. But there's other things too. Like we had a project that used machine learning, you know, random forest model. You keep developing, you know, whatever skills that you you're interested in anyway. It might not perfectly fit with what, you know, if you were to have 100%, you know, full freedom. But you can tailor it to match with whatever that you need,
yeah,
as well as progressing in your career.
Because I think it does really depend on what you end up doing for work. Because the other part too is that, like, I did interview for a lot of other positions, and I did that were vastly different from what you would expect someone in neuroscience to do, but also comes with different restrictions in intellectual freedom or not. Like one of the jobs that I interviewed for was actually for, I think it was called behavioral researcher with a video game company. So,
wow.
It's like you can do research on user data and then like kind of help them develop games and then like take user input and develop it. So it's really varied. And in that type of work, from what I understood, at least from the interviews, is you're kind of bound by what the developers want. And like you're kind of stuck with doing what they ask you to do. So I think echoing Paul's experience as well is that, like, it really depends on the type of work.
Yeah.
Do you see a difference in terms of like team dynamics or just like personality of the people you work with now versus when you worked in academia?
Me, not really, because everyone in my team went through academia, so we all have like a shared background, shared knowledge.
They've all been poisoned by academia before.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing that I found interesting too, is that like when I was in academia, I thought that everyone who was in industry was like spiteful of academia. You know, they all left because they didn't like it. But a lot of the time, that's not always the case. Some people enjoyed the experience, but left because they had families to take care of, mm-hmm. or they left because there was just no opportunities.
Yeah, it's more like, it's less of a spite and more of like an unrequited love type of scenario. Like that's the way I'm viewing it right now.
That's how I felt about it too.
Like academia, I want you, but I don't know if you want me as much. Yeah. You know?
It's like sending love notes on Valentine's Day and then not getting anything
exactly.
back.
Exactly.
Oh my god.
There's something you mentioned, which I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I would love if you elaborated more on it. And because I think it really, if like now we're all like the rest of us, you and Paul are in the industry, the rest of us are doing our PhDs or MDs. And I feel like our failures like kind of have a profound effect on our self-perception.
Yeah.
At least I'm speaking for myself, but I can imagine that a lot of us as PhD students, like the decisions we make in every, like the way we participate in journal club, the way we analyze our data, how fast we're able to get through a data set, or if we choose to work overtime, because even though we're not paid for more than 40 hours a week, the amount of time we end up working is closer to like 70 hours a week. And I feel like it really has an impact on like who we are. Like when I go home, I don't feel like I really left. I feel like I need to think in a way that will get me most like in the most optimal position to be back the day after. Yeah. I don't think of myself. And I know
like
that's
how
bad.
Can I squeeze the day until like to get the most productivity out
exactly.
of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I assume that this is something that you probably are unlearning right now because it's been a few months. Like how is it like by your experience in the industry, did you like learn anything that you think may benefit people who are in academia still?
Good question. I would say that I think one of the things that maybe helped me the most, or that I'm using the most nowadays, is that for us, how it works is that we get requests from external clients, and then we have a project management team that kind of sets deadlines for those requests. So I think for me, the fact that I know that there's a deadline, like there's a deadline coming, that's one thing that helps me a lot. Organizing my day, like I have this Google calendar that I used even during my PhD, where I mark like the hours that I do. But I think the one thing that I did when I was really thinking of leaving, I mean, once I made my choice of leaving, I was like, I don't care about papers anymore, right?
Right.
So what changed a lot is that suddenly I was a lot more in control of my schedule, in the sense that like I get to the office at that time, I leave at that time. It was still in my brain when I got home, because I still want to be productive. I'm still right. in an environment that's there. But I'd say that as someone who, when I was still in academia, that helped me a lot, in the sense that like I could take a breath and then kind of help out of that. And I mean, I kind of sound like I don't want to sound like propaganda, but like but when you start like thinking of going out of academia in general, the fact that you know that there's options outside that are quite varied are also helpful, because you think of, normally when you're in academia, you don't really see what else you can do. So it kind of adds to the stress, right? Yeah. Like you're thinking of, at the end of the day, if I don't publish that paper, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to have a career. And then I'm going to end up on the street.
Yes.
So I think for me, having just a list of options, like I was looking at LinkedIn and then browsing, you know, and then you figure out that you can be like a data analyst for insurance companies, because you have the skills, you know how to code in Python, how to code in R. Maybe you have less information on like using money, but the skills are there.
Yeah, I have terrible information on that.
And I think for me, that's one of the things that I found hardest, right? Because I was lucky to have Paul, because like he kind of was in industry at the time. So like I could turn
you
to
did,
him.
You did it all yourself, Fred. Like honestly, I got lucky too with the job I have now. But I think what both of us had in common is that, you know, the only people from academia that know what it's like outside is people who left, or people that took that step to sort of like, hey, right. what's, you know, what's over the other side? Like what's on the other side? Oh, okay. Like, you know, video game developers, I have the same skills as a, you know, video game developer. And sometimes you don't see it like that.
Yeah.
And once you do, you're breaking through that wall and be like, hey, I can also be this. I can also be this. It's not that I have to do a postdoc.
Yeah.
Right.
And
Because I mean, like just to list a few of the places that I either got offers or interviews at, I went to a railway company as a data analyst. I went to a video game company. I went to one of the hospitals here we have in Montreal, that data analyst. I went, I was interviewed for a biostatistician position, even though like that's not really what I do, but this is in the options. And there's really a lot you can do. Oh, I was also like for a finance department within the government as well. I was interviewed for that. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, like the positions, let's say the federal government, is once you get the exam, because like the position I have, like they had an exam. And you kind of see that it's like analyzing data in R, and you're like, this is familiar. I know this. You know, I've done this in my everyday life.
Right.
And I think that's kind of how I realized it. But talking to people outside of academia also helped. And sometimes like we don't even know how to do that in academia, right? Like where are those industry people that we keep hearing about, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're so hard to come by.
That's it.
They just hide in buildings.
Yeah that's it.
On vacations, they're all on vacations all the time.
We just hide and whine about academia like in the backside. Yeah.
They're not at work after 4:30, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's it.
I was going to ask about that actually, is that like, do you get, because a lot of academia is based on mentorship and like that mentor-mentee relationship. Do you have something similar to that in the industry?
You definitely can.
Yeah.
I'd say that depending on where you work, there is those things that exist. Paul's company has a system like that. I also have a system like that.
My company has a supervisor system, and actually we do get formal reviews twice a year. So we ask everybody that we work with, and they write reviews about us, and then we get, you know, and then an advisor slash supervisor would write us a summary review, and then, you know, and then you get feedback. But the whole time working there, it's a constant feedback loop. Like, you know, you do something, some people will give you feedback and stuff like that. So it does exist. I know that it's not all places.
Because my work is something similar, but like even just like looking for, when I was looking for jobs, right? I knew I was going to exit. I knew I was going to defend in a few months. It's going to sound weird, but my best mentor was TikTok. and I'll explain why.
That is a statement.
I know, yeah. Right? But like, you know, it was just sometimes I was browsing, and I guess the algorithm listened to me somewhere. And then I kept seeing like some videos about like, hey, how to format a CV. And it's like a 2-minute video. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's useful. And then turns out that like I listened to a lot of them, maybe too much. But then like once I had like a working CV, then I went to the McGill Career Center, which we're not aware a lot of what they do. But a lot of what they do is you can bring them a CV or a cover letter, and then you'll have someone sit with you and analyze it. So I think when I got there, my CV was already like in good shape, but they really helped putting it together.
Okay, as we're coming to the end, do you have like one advice you would give to people who are right now in academia and are thinking of switching to industry?
For sure. I would say just create a LinkedIn account and try reaching out to people at companies that you see could be interesting, or even to people that you know around that have been to industry. For instance, my DMs are open. If anyone has questions, like, feel free to reach to me on LinkedIn. But really, like, try to reach out to people. Try to looking outside and, do your own research about industry.
Okay, cool. So yes. Everyone, message Fred.
Yes. Slide okay. Into his DMs.
Thank you so much, Fred and Paul, for being here. This was so interesting.
Thank you.
Yes, thank it you was so a much. Pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me.
Ali, do you want to do the outro?
You've been listening to STEMinism. Thank you so much for tuning in, and tune in every third Friday of the month. We appreciate you being here. And Amelie's going to play us a fun song. That's one of Fred's favorites. So thank you so much.
Yeah. We're going to listen to Going Up the Coast by Clay and Friends. In my room by the moon with no ceiling, I was driving in a van that was older than I+5, hitting Kanye West off the tip of Argentina. Better than drowning engine, ain't got no sick to blame instead of my reflection. So I dreamt, I packed it all like Anderson to end up where it all began. I was going up the coast in a minivan that broke, like my voice when I told you I was leaving. Sit down the road in my room by the moon with no ceiling. With the one I live in Brooklyn, what I give for my apartment. No more homies on the block, like on the corner like a stoplight. Yeah. I'm a ghost, they never notice. Hey. Never showed up for the show biz. Took it back at the beginning when I knew when I was singing. Yeah. Always going up the coast in a minivan that broke, like my voice when I told you I was leaving. Sit down the road in my room by the moon with no ceiling. Who's going up the coast in a minivan?